You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, May 13th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayan. On the 10 biggest lies you've heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and where it stands after yesterday's somewhat surprising filibuster. Also on the program today, Chris Christie, he loves to partay. And even more so, he loves for the taxpayers to pay for it. Meanwhile, speaking of paying for it, Carly Fiorina, she doesn't like to pay for it, at least when it comes to her campaign workers, unless, of course, she's starting a new campaign, and then in which case she will pay off the last one. But, you know, net worth of $25, $30 million doesn't go as far as it used to. I can assure you of that. Meanwhile, Alan West, yes, still alive and kicking, seeing Sharia under every rock. The Vatican has recognized the Palestinian state. And President Obama's big fail on climate change. All that and more on today's program. Should just mention, of course, horrible Amtrak train accident last night outside of Philadelphia, or I should say probably, I think, in Philadelphia. It was a train that originated in D.C., was headed to New York. At least six people are now pronounced dead. 50 or more were injured. Apparently, there was about 250 on the train. It's unclear why the Amtrak derailed. This was not an Acela, but that train that goes from D.C. to New York, I've taken it many times, even the non-Acela goes pretty fast relative to other Amtrak trains. There was footage there because there was actually some NBC producers, I guess, on board. And a congressman, former congressman, Patrick Murphy, right? So no further information there. But, you know, the broadly speaking, we have perennially underfunded Amtrak. I think the last time it got a bump in its funding was after another derailment, I think back in 07, if I remember correctly. Maybe it was 08. And, of course, Republicans loathe the idea of public transportation. They see no value in it and rather would prefer it to be privatized. Now, of course, we know what happens when public transportation is privatized, right? a lot of people don't get the same level of service. And you can talk to me about the market, how it would create great incentives. Are there going to be multiple options on which companies train? I can take from Boston to New York? No. It's just going to be less trains going less places when, in fact, what we need is a greater investment in it. If you look at any Western industrialized country that has a train system, you will find that every single one of them is subsidized by the government. You will also find that they are significantly ahead of us in terms of technology and how well their trains function just in general. But I don't anticipate any increase in funding here. I mean, it's a shame. It's a shame. I don't know that funding would have made a difference in this situation, but it's true. When you get on an Amtrak train, and I ride some of the busiest trains. The Northeast Corridor is a profitable run for Amtrak. Others aren't. It subsidizes, the Northeast Corridor subsidizes train travel for a lot of other parts of the country. The trains I ride, though, you can still see that things are a little bit threadbare. With that said, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great David Dayen about the TPP. There's a lot of stuff that happened yesterday on this. For the first time in 8 years, a sitting president looking for a bill to pass has seen it filibustered. And we haven't even gotten to the real fight on this one. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen, from California, from Los Angeles, California. He's so California, he's in his car, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, he writes for the New Republic. He writes for the Pacific Standard, for Salon, for just about everybody. David Dayen. Hello, David.
Hey, Dave. Let's do lunch.
Yeah, there you go. So
there I am.
LA.
And, you know, I learned the lingo.
When did you learn the lingo?
It took a while. It took a while to establish residency.
There you go. And my understanding is you're writing a book, too. Is that correct?
Yes, I have just completed the first draft. The book should be out. I would hope the book is out next year.
All right. Well, give us a little hint.
So the book is about a collection of people in Florida who really helped uncover the mass foreclosure document scandal of the mass processing of fake documents to courts. And these people weren't lawyers or activists or had any background in real estate or the law. They were foreclosure victims who actually committed a revolutionary act and read their own documents and found discrepancies and then found each other on the web, built their own websites, and started the movement. So that's the story in a nutshell.
Oh, wow. That's going to be fascinating. I should remind people that you are probably the premier writer about mortgage fraud in this country. And I, honestly, like, I noticed, I think there's one other reporter. Is it Morgenstern, Gretchen Morgenstern? She writes about it occasionally at the New York Times. But nobody else is on this beat. And we are still, not only are we still suffering from the impact of the 2008 financial crisis, which was brought about by this rampant mortgage fraud, and obviously the reselling of these fraudulent mortgages, but we're still feeling the impact of it today.
Yeah, and I think maybe the worst part of it is that every day in America, people are still evicted, put into foreclosure on the basis of fraudulent documents that were allegedly weeded out of the system after a series of settlements with the federal government and state attorneys general. But the practices that were done in the foreclosure crisis continue to this day. And these documents continue to be a live ball in courtrooms and registers of deeds, county recorders across the country.
And now this is maybe a bit of a bank shot, but what happened in the Senate yesterday, in some respects, I think, is driven by the failure of the Obama administration and the sort of the broader sense on the left of, let's say, of the left, generally speaking, and perhaps at the left of the Democratic Party, that the banks have not been held accountable, that broadly speaking, there is the establishment, for what it's worth, for lack of a better term, has been getting away with too much. There's just too much inequality, both in terms of money and in terms of accountability. And because I don't know, without that sort of the slow simmering anger about that, and in other times it's obviously it erupts, if we would have seen what we saw yesterday, and I don't want to make too much of a big deal out of it, but it was something that I know a lot of people didn't anticipate.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're broadly speaking to is a topic that Chris Hayes covered in his book Twilight of the Elites, which is this lack of trust and faith in institutions. And how it relates to what happened yesterday is that the Obama administration for the last several months has been pushing a free trade deal, the likes of which we have seen in this country quite a bit over the last 20 years. And the lack of trust in institutions feeds into the fact that when the Obama administration says this is now the most progressive trade deal that's ever been produced in history, there are not a lot of allies to his left that tend to believe him on that, and with good reason. And the same people that benefited from bailout protection in the financial crisis are the same class of elites that will benefit from a corporate-written free trade deal that guarantees, in many ways, profits for multinational corporations and does not offer the same guarantees or protections to ordinary workers.
So before we talk about sort of the dynamic in the Senate, what happened yesterday in terms of that filibuster and how it came about and what we can expect going forward, let's start first with the Trans-Pacific Partnership in and of itself. People have been aware, and we've been talking about, I mean, on this show, we've been talking about it since, I don't know, at the very least, we had Lori Wallach on over 2 years ago, 3 years ago,
sure.
I think, on this show to talk about it. When it started, we started to see documents leaked and get a sense of what this is. But now we see this sort of full court press with President Obama selling this. I don't know if it seems like he's selling it more than he sold anything because he's having to sell it to Democrats, you know what I mean? As opposed to, let's say, the Affordable Care Act, I mean, which, of course, he was out there. But this is pretty intense sales job. And the thing is, he doesn't have a lot of leverage, right? There's no, like, I promise I'll campaign with you in 2 years. And I think that's part of the problem for him on this.
Well, but, it is intense. And it's been unusually aggressive in terms of really just poking a stick in the eye of liberals and allies on the left. The fact that the president spoke at Nike, a company which has a little over a million workers, only 26,000 of which are in the United States, the other 990-odd thousand are overseas making shoes, including about a third of the workforce in Vietnam, which is one of the partners, negotiating partners of the TPP, where the average minimum wage is, I believe, 50 cents an hour. And he went there to tout this agreement and somehow saying that it would bring jobs and prosperity and higher wages to the United States. And of course, the other thing is the unusually personal route that it's taken with respect to Elizabeth Warren and some of her allies, calling them, you know, just a politician, saying that they're doing this to whip up campaign contributions or to get attention, and that their arguments, not just saying that their arguments are wrong, but that they are politically motivated and insincere, and that they're lying about the deal. I mean, that's essentially what Obama has been saying for the last month in very public ways.
What do you think? I mean, I want to get to the sort of the lies that we're being told to support, you know, the sales job. But I mean, why do you think these seem when you talk about these things, they seem like really big missteps. And the idea that there would be political missteps from the Obama administration trying to sell something doesn't shock me per se. But I mean, what do you think the strategy or the sort of, I guess, the theory behind the tactics were in the White House, where, like, you know what, let's just go and let's just make this about us attacking Elizabeth Warren? That to me seems really, really stupid. Just, I mean, honestly, yeah. And let's go to Nike, which, you know, to the extent that there was ever a company that was associated with poor working conditions, you know, like, right. When I think of, like, Naomi Klein's book, No Labels, that's, I think, you know, at least from recollection, like, the swoop was the first thing on there.
Yeah.
I mean, so, or No Logo, I guess it was.
Yeah, No Logo.
I mean, what do you think they were thinking?
Well, I think they're flailing a bit. I mean, one thing is that this president has benefited from his reputation as a member of the left, as a progressive. He has been able to sell things to a large section of the base. And he is still fairly popular with liberals, if you look at the polling. And he has been able to do that because of the reputation he has. In other words, he can say, look, you know who I am. You know what I've been fighting for. Trust me on this. This is the best way to go. And to an extent, people have believed him. And maybe not all of the left, but a good bit of it. So when that is threatened, when that is punctured by a very broad coalition that is opposed to this deal for various different reasons, whether it's the lack of true worker protections, whether it's the potential for outsourcing and job loss and increases in the ballooning trade deficit, whether it's the fact that it's largely a deal about intellectual property and being very aggressive on protecting patents for prescription drugs or Hollywood movie and music content, you know, for whatever reason, when that reputation is punctured, that this is not a deal that would be created by someone who is on the left, he usually lashes out at that point. There's some of the cold rationality of President Obama starts to slip when that bubble is punctured. And it has manifested itself in this really wrong-headed, personal series of attacks at someone who really has gained a very, very exalted status among liberals over the last couple years. And so I can't pinpoint the strategy here, but I know that the president's reputation as a liberal is critically important to his governing agenda. And when that is threatened, he takes it personally.
I mean, it's so hard to get your arms around the idea that, like, he's just being a baby about it in some way.
I mean, right.
And I don't know. There was a story on Politico today saying, like, this is just what he's a straight shooter. What he thinks that, you know, he thinks there's calcified thinking on the left about these
right.
things. Which
there's
of course
a second part of this too, and it speaks to that, and that is the fact that Washington is really wired. You know, I mean, Josh Marshall talks about Washington being wired for conservatism. Well, it's certainly wired for these kinds of neoliberal trade deals that have been passed for decades. And usually every single editorial board at every newspaper lines up in favor of free trade. The policy mandarins on the center, left, and right usually line up on free trade. And so this is also about signaling to that sort of what Jeff Conaton in his book called the blob, that group of lobbyists and hangers-on and operatives, that Obama has, he's a very serious person, right? That he is in alignment with his dominance neoliberal consensus about the benefits of trade. I mean, the problem is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership really isn't a trade deal. We have free trade agreements with half of the countries in TPP, and the vast majority of economic output from the one country that we don't have sort of a modern free trade agreement with is with Japan, and their tariffs are incredibly low. So the idea that this is going to open new markets or expand lower tariffs and present opportunities for exports is just not true.
It's just completely untrue. It seems to me that it's really more of, and I should say too, that this whole notion of, like, you know, he's dealing with calcified thinking on the left. You had a piece, I don't know if it was today or the other day, in I think it was Salon, about how his rhetoric today sounds exactly like the Gore Clinton or Clinton Gore rhetoric from the early 90s when they were selling NAFTA, and particularly in that debate with Warren Perot, Ross Perot and Gore on Larry King's show.
Yeah.
But
that was actually in the New Republic, and at that time Al Gore said this is the most progressive trade agreement in history, and said that there were enforceable labor and environmental standards in this agreement that would force Mexico to change their practices and bring high standards to that country. And it just didn't happen. And subsequent trade agreements it didn't happen in. Subsequent trade agreements which were negotiated with standards that are higher than are likely in the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
You know, I think, like, you know, people can understand this agreement less as a trade agreement and more as like a commerce agreement, right? Because the idea is that they really want to set up. I mean, it seems to me, and then obviously the different industries want to make sure that it's favorable to them, but they want to set up a regime of regulation that is going to be standardized around the world, but they want that regulation to be frozen in amber at that point. And
That's correct. They want
to give the opportunity to change that regulation, if there's any changes at all, not to the various countries who may find out that, like, hey, wait a second, this product is really dangerous. You know, this is the next tobacco. Well, we can't outlaw it. We can't, you know, because we already have this regulatory scheme that's in there. And the reason why they want to freeze it in amber is so that businesses and industries can make more money. This is basically getting the government and governments, period, out of the way of businesses and their profit-making intentions, regardless of who pays the price in any given country or anywhere. All right, so but let's use that and enter into the, sort of the lies, because when we get down to like your lie number, I don't know which one it is, about China, this is also sort of, you know, because what I find really interesting too in terms of the how much this is tied into the Asian pivot and just trying to understand why President Obama is so intense about this, like not wanting to lose this one. I mean, can you imagine if there was this much sort of like haranguing when it came to the American Jobs Creation Act, you know, that second swipe at a stimulus that came 2 years too late. But let's go to this number one, 40%. So my understanding, David, and I'll play the role of the unsuspecting public. This is going to be huge because this involves 40% of the global GDP. We got to get this done or this could have massive impact on the global GDP.
Right. The United States of America represents 22% of global GDP. So a bill naming a post office involves 22% of global GDP. As I said, there are 6 free trade agreements among the 12 countries in this deal. We already have free trade agreements with zero tariffs or near zero tariffs with 6 of those countries. And Japan is really the dominant country that we don't have an active free trade agreement with, and their average tariff is something like 1.2%. So the idea that this will suddenly open up these new markets, the only markets that will open up are a skinny group of countries whose consumers can't really afford U.S. products.
And really, I mean, to a certain extent, you start to understand, you know, sort of why what this is about then at that point. It's really sort of like down the road, again, getting taking all the players off the table so that when China is ultimately included in this, they adopt the scheme that we've already developed. Whether or not that has any real world implications, it is like a prestige thing, right? China is entering into our deal. We're not entering into China's deal.
Yeah, and this is meant to be an open agreement. It's meant to allow countries to enter into it. And it's really meant to build that global regulatory ceiling, whether it's on workplace safety or food inspection or financial regulation or whatever, so that corporations are protected when they invest from one country to the next, that they don't have to really change their operations in any meaningful way. And in fact, if you look at the investor state dispute settlement provisions of the agreement, it really gives bailout insurance to these companies investing abroad that if the country changes their regulations or in some way discriminates against that country, it allows them to recoup their investment through an extrajudicial tribunal process. And so you're essentially taking the U.S. business-friendly climate and exporting it abroad so that companies can feel very secure that their investments are protected. Now, no worker can make a dispute in this agreement so that their right to hold a job and collectively bargain is protected in the same manner. The host government has to be appealed to in order to get that kind of protection. There's no worker state dispute settlement in this deal.
People should envision this. People
only
understand.
Corporations get this benefit.
This is what it would look like if there were the same type of consumer or worker expectation protections, let's say. And we should say this is also the same for the United States. I mean, theoretically, if we want to And you're going to talk about maybe, I think, the patents. If we want to shorten, patent protection on new medications from the current 12 years to 7 years, we may be prohibited by the TPP from doing that. If we want to bulk negotiate for drugs in Medicare, we may be prohibited by this agreement from doing it. And then
the president says, well, no U.S. laws can be changed by this agreement. And that's only true so far as it goes, because what happens is the companies can sue the United States and win settlements, win money, and that could lead to the country saying, well, this is now too expensive for us to change this regulation. It's cost prohibitive, and we're going to have to change back.
We as a nation need to pay for the right to change our own laws.
Right, right. And this has happened. It's even happened in third parties. Like New Zealand wanted to change their cigarette packaging, but they saw that Australia was sued by Philip Morris when they tried to change their cigarette packaging, so New Zealand held off on the law. So it doesn't just affect the country being sued, but other countries who are watching this and worried that they'll get a ton of bricks thrown on them if they try to change their own laws.
All right, let's go to job creation. This is lie number two. The White House says the deal would support an additional 650,000 jobs. Why do you hate America, David Dayan?
Well, that was based on a study, and the author came out and said that's an incorrect way to look at this study, and that job creation is not necessarily a component of this agreement, and that trade deals in general they change the mix of jobs potentially, but they did not create more. And in fact, what we've seen, like if you look at the South Korea Free Trade Agreement, which was signed in 2011 by this president, and it was claimed that this would create a number of jobs in the United States, it's cost 75,000 because the trade deficit has gone up by $12 billion in the 4 years since that agreement has been presented. So it's not true. And if anything, there's more protectionism in this agreement in terms of the intellectual property piece, which will do nothing. It will not create jobs. It will raise prices for consumers on prescription drugs and Hollywood content.
All right. And so in getting to that that South Korean trade deal. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that, like, you know, in the selling of this, there's a claim that we're going to raise our exports, but we never hear about the other half of trade, which apparently is when you import. Tell us about, you use the example of the South Korea deal where, okay, exports have gone up, but, by $1 billion, but imports have gone up by $12 billion.
Exactly. So, you know, talking about trade and not discussing both imports and exports is like giving the score of a ball game and saying Dodgers 4, and that's it. So the problem is that we have a trade deficit when our imports, what we're purchasing from abroad, exceeds what we export and deliver abroad. And that affects wages, that affects jobs, and that affects the larger economy, because a key figure in GDP growth is the balance of trade. So you can't just say, as the U.S. trade rep and the president has been saying, that what we want to do is increase exports, and this agreement will give us the ability to increase exports. It's a half-truth, literally, because you're not talking about the other side of the equation.
And this raises another issue that came into play yesterday, and I don't want to jump ahead by it too much, but it has to do with currency manipulation, which sometimes, I don't know if it, in the case of South Korea, is as much of an issue. But
it is.
All right, so
it is in the case of South Korea and Japan, one of the major partners in the TPP, and also China, who's not a signatory to TPP. And that's when countries artificially manipulate their currency. They create a lower currency so that their exports are cheaper. The reason that we're in kind of mired in a weird slump right now in our economy is that the dollar is very strong, and our exports subsequently are very expensive, prohibitively so. And so the idea is that we should take stronger action when countries are manipulating their currency in a bid to increase their balance of trade. And this agreement has no currency provisions whatsoever. And the White House has said that any currency provisions would undermine the entire agreement and upset it.
And we'll talk about that again in the context of the filibuster that took place yesterday in a moment. But let's going through these. Well, you've addressed the idea that this is the most progressive trade deal in history. We've heard that one before. Changing laws. We've talked about the investor-state dispute settlement. Right. And what about weakening Dodd-Frank?
Yeah. So. Like anything else, you can put into a trade agreement a chapter on financial regulation, which will harmonize those regulations and set regulatory ceilings. In fact, in the 1997 WTO agreement, there is a prohibition on Glass-Steagall-like firewalls between commercial and investment banking. And the U.S. signed this agreement, and in a note, in a proviso, said, we are going to get rid of Glass-Steagall by the time that this agreement is actually signed. And indeed, they did in 1999. So this is not hypothetical. It's happened before. Elizabeth Warren says it can happen again. There is a separate agreement being negotiated between the U.S. and Europe called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, called TTIP. And European banks want to create this harmonization of regulation and have a financial regulatory chapter in. And Jack Lew testified to Congress that we don't want this because usually in trade agreements, when you put in those kinds of regulatory pieces, that they weaken national and international laws. And so the White House has essentially admitted that the opposite of what they've been saying in campaigning for this, that Dodd-Frank could easily be weakened by a trade deal. And while it may not be the most direct way that you would want to do that, you could just hire regulators that look the other way as a matter of course, it is certainly a method that can be taken.
And, of course, it on top of that, in the event that we have another catastrophic failure of our banking system and we decide we want to go further, that seems to be off the table, right? I mean,
it could be. It's very unclear how you would get around some of these strictures. And of course, if a bank thought that you were undermining the trade agreement by going further than what the agreement allowed, they can sue you. In a special court that is not a U.S. court, a special tribunal, and they can win a large monetary penalty based on the expected future profits that they would lose if you changed your regulation in that fashion.
Okay, stopping China. President Obama frequently cast TPP as a way to contain China. Now, I think this part of it is really sort of the most fascinating, because for a long time, the neocons in Washington have been terrified of China for at least a couple of decades. I think even when the Project for New American Century was written about, it was a function of how do we ultimately deal with China. And everything that we have done, I think, over the past 20 years from foreign policy, to the extent that it's been influenced by them, has been a function of that. We are reorienting our Navy. We're pivoting to Asia. You can see this. I visited the USS Iowa a couple of months ago and down the road from you. And they've got it all diagrammed out there where you can see the sort of the different pivots under different administrations. So the idea is, and I think we talked about this earlier, was we're going to create this system. We're going to basically get all the world's China, or possibly all of China's potential trading partners, into this system, and then China will have to join, and it will be under the auspices of our rules, I guess, theoretically, like no more knockoff, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies or whatever, you know, you can buy in China, you know, on DVD.
Right.
That seems to be it, right? But I mean, it seems to me it's Pyrrhic because of what you point out here, that it really is just
absurd.
More about, like,
I mean,
we just want
I mean,
to be able to say
it. It's absurd. It's absurd that you would think that somehow China would be left out of the Asian economic equation when they're the largest economy in that part of the world, and indeed soon to become the, if not there already, the largest economy in the world. And so the idea that they're not going to be a factor is ludicrous. And when we're talking about we need to write the rules of global trade our way rather than China's way, that makes an assumption that these are our trade rules and not the trade rules of multinational corporations. Brad Sherman, who's a congressman in the San Fernando Valley here, said to me that, you know, taking credit for these trade rules as American trade rules would be like citizens of Madrid being proud of the Spanish flu.
Right.
These are not our trade rules. These are Wall Street's trade rules. These are multinational corporate trade rules. And China really isn't, they don't stand to lose much from these trade rules. The rules of origin rules, in other words, the idea that China can create products and then ship them to a TPP member country, and that member country can slap a label on it that says made in Vietnam or made in Malaysia, and then send them to the United States duty-free, if anything, this could help China, because they get tariff-free distribution of their goods without having to abide by any of the rules within the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So, and that's a potential that can happen based on rules of origin rules. Sometimes you only have to make 35% of a good in order to have it, say, made in your country.
That's why I think this is, I think that's another indication of how much this is just about us wanting to, or rather certain industries that have had the most influence in this process, wanting to make sure that their their regulatory protections exist, and these are the worst of the worst as far as I'm concerned about regulatory protections, right? I mean, it is patents that exist for too long. It is licensing copyrights that exist for too long, that mm-hmm. system has been abused. And this is basically just trying to import that. That's what gives me that notion. But
right. And it's about the ability to pollute and the ability to deny collective bargaining. I mean, we have trade agreements with countries like Colombia where a trade unionist is murdered every other week. And when you ask the U.S. trade rep about that, they say, well, it's getting better. It's they're murdering less people than they did maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's there's a Monty Python sketch about one of these somebody objecting to cannibalism in the Royal Navy, saying that it is now well known that we have the problem relatively under control. So that's basically the idea that we're talking about here, and it's you're setting the rules for global trade by the auspices of multinational corporations that seek to benefit from it, not for the benefit of countries or their individual workers.
Okay, so with just the couple of minutes that we have left here, walk us through. Yesterday, in the Senate, something happened that I don't think anybody would have predicted 2 or 3 months ago. I mean, everybody sort of anticipated the real problem could be in the House because
right.
The dynamic in the House is that John Boehner needs a certain number. Nobody knows what that number is. I don't know if John Boehner knows what that number is of Democratic votes, because he's going to lose. This is largely supported by the Republicans, but they're going to lose Nobody knows whether it's 25, 50, 75 right. Republican votes because just of the it's giving Obama a win type of situation. And
right. Well, it's doing more than that. And I think we need to back up and just explain, you know, there are two votes. The first vote and what happened in the Senate yesterday was a vote on what's called fast track. And that gives the president authority to negotiate trade deals. And then when they are finished and negotiated and finalized, he brings them back to Congress. And under a fast-track process, he gets an expedited, guaranteed review and vote on the agreements without a filibuster and without the opportunity for amendment. It's just an up or down vote.
And let me just correct one thing. We should say he or she in terms of the president.
He or she. I'm sorry. Because it's a six-year deal.
Right.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. And that's one of the problems Warren has with Dodd-Frank is that maybe this president wouldn't vote to undermine Dodd-Frank in the trade agreement.
But Carly Fiorina might.
Yeah, Carly Fiorina might. Scott Walker might. So that's her point. So, yes. So the problem that I think Tea Party Republicans have is that you're giving the executive much more authority.
Right.
And you're taking away congressional authority very deliberately. That bill came up, Trade Promotion Authority, or Fast Track, came up in the Senate yesterday. And Harry Reid is against this bill. And so his gambit was that, well, there were a lot of bills that actually passed the Senate Finance Committee with respect to trade, four bills, in fact. One is trade adjustment assistance, where workers who are displaced by trade get a little monetary benefit. One is an African trade bill, and one is a customs enforcement bill, which has a lot of the enforcement capacity of TPP of Trade Promotion Authority and TPP that goes beyond what I think the president and congressional Republicans really want in the bill. It includes a piece on currency manipulation that allows it's much stronger and stiffer and forces the executive branch to really take a strong line against currency manipulation. It also has a human trafficking piece that, you know, Malaysia is a serial human trafficking abuser, and they're a signatory to TPP, and this would essentially ban products made through forced labor from coming into the country. So Reid wanted all four of those bills to come together. And he said, if you're not going to give us a guaranteed vote on all four of those bills at the same time, we're not going to give you any votes for it. And McConnell said, I'll give you trade adjustment assistance, but not these other ones. Because the enforcement bill with currency manipulation piece and human trafficking piece is a real problem for TPP, that it could unravel the agreement, which has been negotiated for the last 5 years.
So, in other words, Harry Reid is basically putting a poison pill into this this package.
Correct. And so McConnell didn't want to put the poison pill, didn't want to guarantee a vote on that part of the bill, or that extra bill. And Reid got all the Democrats, except for one, Tom Carper, to withhold votes. And, of course, this was on the motion to proceed to the legislation, and that's filibusterable, and it needed 60 votes, and it only got 52 yesterday because no Democrats except for Carper would agree to it. So you had 45 votes against.
So, okay, now, so what happens next? I mean,
what happens next is they probably try again. There is a block of pro-trade senators. Ron Wyden helped negotiate this agreement. He came out of a meeting and said, if you don't give us the four bills, we're not going to go along with it. There is probably an accommodation that can be made for Wyden. And if Wyden goes, he probably brings along enough people to get the agreement through. So that's what we're waiting on. Where is that negotiation going, and how will the White House play into that? The fight always was going to be in the House and continues to always, it will be in the House. I'm not 100% certain, but I'm maybe 70% certain that you're going to see this this trade promotion authority pass the U.S. Senate. I'm less certain today than I was yesterday because you did get, you know, a great deal of solidarity among Democrats against this, unless you had what effectively are poison pills in the agreement.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like Harry Reid's strategy is here to delay as much as we can, because soon, in a couple of weeks, I mean, there's a couple of bills that have to be dealt with in the Senate. The Patriot Act, the FISA Act, I think, comes up for renewal. That's going to be contentious, particularly after that recent court case. I think there's a highway bill that needs to be dealt with. So if he can get to June 1st, then there is maybe a brief recess. And then they come back. If he can play this out, it starts to get caught in the sort of the whirlpool, if you will, of the presidential elections.
It's correct. And it becomes a game of inches. And then, you know, you have the budget that has to be dealt with, and you have the debt ceiling that has to be dealt with. And there's all these other things that would take precedence. And then you push it out and push it out and push it out. And yes, it gets caught up in the maelstrom of the presidential election, which, you know, it wouldn't take too long. And then maybe you get the August recess and you get people flooding congressional offices and town hall meetings. So, yes, that's the idea, delay this out. I think that's what Reid wants to do. And you had this amazing spectacle yesterday of Mitch McConnell whining about obstructionism in the U.S. Senate and how Democrats wouldn't even allow them to begin work on debating this bill, which is just such a horrible, undemocratic process, especially coming from McConnell, who did the exact same thing for the last 8 years.
Right. Well, David Dayen, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate your catching us up. Folks, you know now everything there is to know about this, both from a process standpoint, from a rhetorical standpoint, from a policy standpoint. So go forth and tell people about it. David Dayen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, man.
All right, Sam. Thanks.
Bye-bye. And I'll remind people that the best way to listen to David Dayen or know what David Dayen is writing, to go to his Tumblr. So he basically has a Tumblr because he writes for so many different publications. I always go to his Tumblr every day because he's like a machine. He writes so much and knowledgeably. So check that out. Folks, pick up our app. It's free. I don't even know why I have to say this. I'm just doing you a favor. The app is completely free. Well, then you're sitting there going like, well, what do you get out of it, Sam? I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to justify having spent all that cash on it. Because I thought by now I would figure out a way of making it pay off, and I never did. This is my business acumen. It's good that we have an app. It's easier for my folks to listen to the show. It's much easier for you to listen to the show. But at this point, we have the app. I feel better if more people are listening via the app. Then I feel like it was worthwhile, even though I haven't figured out how to actually make it benefit the show. Other shows don't have an app like this. So pick it up. It's free at majorityapp.com. Works for Android, works for iPhone. Also, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm, or you go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. They have free shipping now, justcoffee.coop. And, you know, I said this yesterday, but nobody did it. A review on iTunes, please. Come on, man. Seriously. Let's get it going. Marin gets one like every day. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, of course, you can IM me. You can do so through the app. See you in a minute.